Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And let's, instead of going through the obligatories, let's really start off with where are we? Because we're halfway through the year regarding content. This is not a show where, if I am entertaining in any way, it is by accident. What the focus of this show is to educate and empower. Remember, knowledge is power. And if you're being entertained, you're just learning facts of things that just you can't do anything about. That's exactly what the conservative entertainers are doing. They're pointing out, oh, look at these terrible things. And they're actually trying to convince you that these solutions, which we have actually proven, we've gone over this for a couple of years now, that the seven paths, the party system, has no intent, current party system has no intent in fixing our political problems and the constitutional crisis that we're in. The courts have no intent. I mean, they're fat cows. So they have no vested interest in fixing the problem. They are in control. We have a judiciary form of government today, folks. So as we go down all these other options, such as the convention, such as, I'll just say, nullification, when we look at both of those options, nullification just ignores the problem, and the convention of states, whether you like it or not, folks, if you support the convention of states, all you're doing is you're basically putting lipstick on, not a pig, but you're just basically wasting time in making, you're actually creating a pig. We can, if you have a amendment that you really believe is the silver bullet that will get the federal government into full compliance of the Constitution, please send it to me, because one does not exist. As we have basically worked through this, changing the Constitution, the Constitutional Convention, or the Convention of States action, whatever their name is today, whatever the people that are trying to promote this Constitutional Convention, they have no intent of fixing the problem. You realize that when the problem gets fixed, then their money goes away. People have to get jobs. It's kind of like when the Lord comes, the second coming, everybody is going to actually have to, you know, contribute, because there's no more living off of the backs and the toils of others. We'll actually be, you know, in a world where personal accountability will actually be not a rampant problem, but it will be the paradigm of the day. Helping each other. Doing things, you know, in harmony with everybody. So, as we look at the grand scheme of, you know, who will be governing. So, as we look at the four paths we just covered, the party, the courts, the convention, and nullification, neither of those will actually solve the problem. They don't even address the real problem. They can't, because the real problem is getting compliance from the federal government, the state government, and your county government to the Constitution. So what we have to do is we actually need to do one specific thing, but let's go through the other two potential actions, right? So we've got the sovereign citizen movement, or what I call it, the secession movement. The secession movement is a group of patriots that really believe that there's no saving the Constitution. The general assemblies are out there. They say that they tell you that they're very in line with the Constitution, and yet they are creating a shadow government. Their outcome is creating a shadow government, and basically it is an insurrection against the Constitution. Oh, they can't have it both ways. You can't actually start communicating to The Hague. You can't claim to have created a constitutional or a, I'll just say, the sovereignty of the county and the sovereignty of the state with a minority of the people of the county and a minority of the people of the state. I mean, there's so many different problems with the paradigm that it's just not worth going into at this point. But when we look at the general assemblies and what they're doing with their shadow governments, and we look at the different states nationals, we look at the different sovereign citizen movements, just basically going down the path of becoming an inhabitant and going through the legal process of supposedly owning, taking full control of your land. Possession, they say, is 9/10 of the law. But when it comes to force, when it comes to governing and deadly force, there it doesn't matter, you know, whether you have the papers to it or not. As a matter of fact, I'm pretty sure that throughout the annals of history, every time a nation was conquered, didn't matter who had what piece of paper. And so you're fooling yourself if you think going down this path, you've secured your own little plot. You've done it. You're now protected from the invasion or what you think might could happen. But the reality is that you have basically taken yourself out of the grand number of those who could be able to resist and actually overcome this. In other words, you've seceded. You've left. You've divorced yourself. You've walked out on the family. You've walked out on the union. You've walked out on the, I'll just say, your citizenship, because that's exactly what you're doing. You are becoming impotent in being able to be involved, period. Why is that? Because when we look at what they actually did, they abjured their allegiance to the Constitution, which means that they don't have Constitution. So if you're one of those, and you think you're a sovereign citizen, well, when it comes down to the time when you're going into a court, you think that you're above that court, but those who have the deadly force every time will win. The only way that court can be restored to a court that recognizes the inalienable rights that are protected by that Constitution, which you don't have the protections of, and I'm not very sympathetic for these people, because the selfish motivation behind this, why do most people do this? Because they don't want to pay taxes. Now, granted, there are a few cases, but I do not think it's the norm. I think it's a very self-serving group of people that are behind all of this, and they're all trying, or they're delusional. So these last two cases, the secessionist and this next one, these are the delusional people, because they really think, they've never really looked at, you know, the whole, how will it all pan out? Look at history. History will tell you exactly what's going to happen, and you're going to lose, because you can't do anything. You have deliberately removed, it's like the parent, regardless of the gender, regardless of the sex, the parent that walks out on the family no longer has say in what those children are going to be doing. You have to come back into the family. You have to be welcomed by those, you know, the family members, that both the children and that spouse that you walked out on. So this is a delusion, thinking, oh yes, I am gaining everything, when actually you've given away everything. The other camp, the sixth camp, or the final camp, other than the seventh and the only camp to be in, that will actually solve the problem. The sixth camp is those armed revolutionists. Those people who believe, and this is the umbrella of the Second Amendment, folks. It's interesting that they've created their own importance, because they believe that they're going to have to fight. They're telling everybody, and there's the swirling. The swirling's been out there. I don't know how long I've heard the tired argument that there is going to be a civil war in America. The civil war means that there's actually some equality between the two sides. I am here to tell you that they're hedging their bets, to a point where they will have, you know, they won't lose any life, and they don't even need to worry anymore about actually putting life in harm's way. As a matter of fact, they'll get to a point where they will have such a level of control to squeeze you. They get, as I've looked, and we've seen this, we've seen as America has helped prosecute, I'll just say, tyrants or people where we've extracted justice in a blink of an eye, where we've dropped a missile on a home because we knew a bad person was there, or a drone today, these strikes. I mean, I remember back in the 90s where we actually dropped some bombs in Georgia, Kosovo, and so forth to actually, you know, boom, take people out. We have done this. And so as we kind of look at, you know, that was old technology compared to today, folks. Shoot, they have really maniacal ways of just killing lots of people. And the reality is the globalist message has been, we're ignoring this. We are ignoring that we have too many people on this earth, according to them. And they have convinced all of the kids, and this is why the kids have completely, they're lost. There are very few kids that really have a good handle on what needs to happen, what they need to do. Very few. And that's only because the education system has perfected its ability to indoctrinate, which is why we are in the situation we're in, because we've got the secessionists, we've got those people out there that are convinced that they're going to fight this civil war. And it, when all of a sudden the crap hits the fan, look at COVID, and look at how many people were, you know, fighting back, and the level of fighting back. It was nothing compared to the level of fighting back against the Constitution the previous year. Remember the 2020 revolts, the George Foremans and so forth? Those kids were willing to burn down your city because they believe the agenda that they've been indoctrinated. Everybody else, as they get older and older, they may be training, but I'm going to tell you, they're not going to be able to wage even a decent offensive because the technology is different. We are not a society where all muskets are equal like our forefathers. There was very little difference between what Britain could bring to the table and what the American militia could bring to the table. And the reason why it's things are different today is because the government has actually positioned us and our militia in such a way that the militia doesn't even exist anymore. If we were actually following the Constitution, every single one of our problems would go away. We wouldn't even worry about world threats because we all would be a part of the national defense system. We wouldn't want somebody to do our fighting for us. We are our biggest problem. But the reality is the only way to get to that point, to where the American paradigm becomes the paradigm for the people of the world, for individual liberty and the protection of inalienable rights. There isn't a person that is alive that doesn't want to espouse to those things. There may be people out there that just hate the United States because they've been equally indoctrinated. They may hate the Constitution. They may hate the principles of liberty. But there's not a person, when you boil it down, I've yet to meet a person that actually says, I want you to tell me what I'm going to eat today. I want you to tell me what I'm going to wear. I want you to tell me what job I'm going to do today. Everybody wants the liberty to choose what they're eating, where they sleep, what they're going to do. And sometimes we don't have many choices. And that's because those options have been taken from us. So we started off with the Tory Act. So I want to just kind of do a quick review before I get into the congressional record. We started off with the Tory Acts, right? And so we showed you that when the colonists started recognizing that they were losing their rights, and actually it required some British people, like this guy named Otis, I don't know, I'm bad with names. But he started helping people understand. And so people actually started standing up and saying, hey, we've got these rights as Englishmen. And so as Britain started trying to take money and our rights away, and basically says, you're a part of the empire, but you are our subjects. You are not, a citizen of Britain. They did not, and they refused, even though you came there as citizens and we established the colonies as an extension of Britain, they quickly changed over time. And when they realized that they were getting a little tight on the money, they were going to get the money out of the Americas. So the Tory Acts is the awakening of the people under the British monarchical theocracy, and people started awakening to this idea that they were no longer Englishmen, that they were subjects. And this is when they actually started demanding their rights as Englishmen, no taxation without representation. They started regurgitating those rights that were ingrained in the Magna Carta and the Glorious Bill of Rights. And so as they started creating the Tory Acts, at the instance of creating the Tory Acts, because this all kind of happened slowly at the local provincial level, people started getting organized. As the king started dismissing the governments of the colonies, provincial governments started getting established because people weren't going to take this. They weren't going to allow themselves to become subjects. So they used common law, and they used these rights as Englishmen. They used this thing called, it's all a part of the Magna Carta Bill of Rights, and these rights of the Englishmen. They asserted and they demanded their rights. So they got organized, and they eventually created the Articles of Association, and they created a petition to the king. And that's when the Tory Acts started coming out. We lead with the Tory Acts, but technically it's kind of like the second or third phase or stage in moving towards the revolution. But it's the critical part. Why? And that's why we lead with this. This is you getting organized at the local level, taking back your county, demanding that under the fundamental principles of the Declaration of Independence, that we the people institute our government. We do not allow government to come in and say, we're going to give you this government, and they're going to govern you, and they're going to govern you the way we tell them to. See, over time, that's exactly what's happened. Even though you think you're electing these people, they've created unconstitutional rules that have basically taken your representation away from you. Now they're all just admins to this central cog of a national government that was never created. This is why I tell you that if you accept the unconstitutional institution of government, you have a hard row to hoe. You have to deny that these things are legitimate because you can't prove that they are. There's not one person out there that can prove that these are legitimate. So why would you continue to say, well, they're these corporations, they're doing these things. They don't have the authority to do that. And you have to help everybody in your county recognize that that authority doesn't exist, because when people realize that they're wielding power that did not come from you, then you start waking up. This is the beast that they're keeping asleep. And you are a big part of that. So The Tory Acts are the most critical because it identifies what we have to do. We have to get organized and unite on demanding compliance. They, back in the Tory Acts, they were demanding compliance to their rights as Englishmen, those things that were guaranteed them under the Magna Carta and the Glorious Bill of Rights. So then we kind of covered the Declaration of Independence on the on July. We kind of waited until July to do that. But we covered Thomas Jefferson's original draft and the basic announcement of war, that we didn't institute this form of government, that we instituted as Britain a long time ago, and we have a right to alter or abolish that. So moving forward, we said we're not going to be a part of this, and we're going to create our own. And at that same time, we had to modify the Articles of Association because it was a association confederacy, not a committed confederacy. So they created the Articles of Confederation. We went through all of these documents, folks. So if you go into the academic source documents page on Reclaiming the Republic, boom, 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 we've got them all. Then you go through the podcast page, start at the very bottom with January, and work your way up as we cover these documents. We tell you when we're covering them. We're reading these. So the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union, then we actually covered, because things were transpiring going into the convention. They were actually proving that the Articles of Confederation were actually a failure. And there are people today that are trying to convince you we got to go back to those. So we go through the details of the Articles of Confederation. Then we go through the amendments that they tried to get to the Articles of Confederation that just couldn't sink in. So we went through all of the amendments, 8 amendments total. We went through all of them. We gave them to you. We read these, and we proved the problems with the Articles of Confederation were insurmountable, and nobody was going to amend them. Therefore, it called for the proposal for the, and it came out of the proceedings of Annapolis to basically remedy the defects of the Articles of Confederation and to actually deal with the exigencies of the Union. So they went into this convention, the state convention, which we call the Convention of the Articles, no, it's not Article 5, forgive me, the Constitutional Convention of 1787. And in doing that, we kind of show you how the delegates were selected and so forth to prove to you that those who went into that convention had all the authority to do everything they did. So and why is this important? Because there are patriots that tell you that that was a runaway convention. Anybody that asserts to you that the convention, the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, 1787, was a runaway convention, they're lying to you, and they can't prove, they cannot prove that all they have is people hearsay making personal assertions in letters or what have you, stating that, yeah, you know, it seemed like they were a little out of scope. No. The divine hand of providence did everything to make sure that what was going to happen in America would become a permanent fixture as a footstool for protecting individual liberty and individual sovereignty for all people here on the earth. That's why this is so amazing when we really look at the Constitution today, and as well as it has been laid out still 250 years later. 250 years, next year it'll be 250 years. And that Constitution is still the most relevant and the most perfect document that preserves and creates a self-governing system that allows the people all liberties and actually gives them a self-governing system. We just have to get out of our idea. We got to change our paradigm to no longer accepting professional government like mercenaries, because that's when they turn their guns and they turn their power against us. We have to take this back. So when we come back, I'll kind of finish wrapping up to where we are today.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so, and I hope you see the logic of what we're doing. We're giving you the empirical data, the facts of what actually happened. We're not giving you these warm and fuzzies out of these little, you know, I'll just say enclaves, these small little areas like in states. Because when we look at the documents, the artifacts that people use, these have nothing to do, like with the General Assembly, where a judge says, oh, yeah, this right's something that, this is a legitimate right. Really? Then it would have been in the Constitution. It would have been in the Bill of Rights as this ability to create a people government, a democracy in our Republican form of government. When we created this new Republican form of government, I've covered this to ad nauseum. That this new Republican form of government was of the case where the sovereigns are equally represented separately in two separate houses of legislature. The people are represented in the House, and the government that we've created is represented in the Senate, i.e. at the state level, that would be the county and the people. And at the federal level, that would be the people in the House, and the Senate would represent the state. And that's, and it was basically created at the federal level. Now, the states weren't obligated to form into this configuration. And as they did, they kind of meandered, not understanding the inherent beauty of that system, of the checks and balances in doing that. This is why when we look today, why are we so screwed up? Because we're far more of a democracy than we are of a Republican form of government, a representative government of the sovereigns. We've lost sight of the fact that we actually create a sovereign government. Folks, you can't have a government that can't do anything. That's going back to the Articles of Association. And at least the Articles of Confederation had a little bit of power, if everybody would agree. But it was under the Constitution where certain powers were given and the ability to coerce for those powers only were granted and delegated. And that's it. And so the states had the residual mass of all powers not granted. Here's the problem. If the people did not delegate the powers to the state, then that doesn't mean that the states had all powers. They only had the powers delegated to them. This was the whole principle of the Declaration of Independence, that we, the people, institute and empower. We delegate to our government in a constitution what powers they have. This idea of general powers is putting on the cloak of a monarchy, putting on a cloak of an unlimited government. And the concept of an unlimited government was completely broken asunder in that constitutional convention. They created this level of protection. So in other words, the states, as they started forming or rechanging the original 13 states, as they started changing themselves, they didn't do a good job because they meandered. They didn't understand some of the underlying principles to get things right. Now, we're at this point where we see all of these problems, and hindsight being 2020, we have hindsight now. We can get things right. The question is, can you get the people to acknowledge this? Because there's way too many people out there, especially in the blue states, that want to be able to have government serve them. They think that that is the way forward. Well, the good thing, folks, is that the populated states is the minority, and the minority can't overpower the majority in this Republican form of government. We're not a democracy, but everybody has convinced everybody that we are. And this is why in the blue states, the bluer the state, the more in bed with the idea of democracy they are. The more the redder the state, the more redder. I know that this is really bad language, bad English grammar. So as we look at the phases of going from a very dark red to a very blue, it is where the people want a limited government. They don't want a democracy. They want their rights protected. But we have been so poorly educated that even in the dark red states, they don't get it. They're starting to. You're starting to get this. And so you have to be the statesman. You have to stand up. We've written articles, and I'm working again. I'm hoping by the end of this year, I'll have the final article done, and I'll actually have some rewrites to some of the other articles by the end of the year. Getting the time to do this is tough. I have hope that by sometime next year, I'll be getting assistance with this program to where we're actually going to be giving you information from other areas around the nation. And to do that, we need your help. So that to actually start providing, because folks, in 2026, that is the 250th anniversary. In 2028, if we're not planning in the election of 2026 moving forward of taking back this country, in 2028, I just feel like we're getting too far across this line. We're being dragged too far away from this line. I think that we can, right now, start planning so that through the 2026 election, we will be positioned for the 2028 election. We have to start getting involved. Read Why Counties Matter Most, because I really drive these principles through so that everybody actually understands the architecture and the framework of the government we're supposed to be functioning under. And that's the one that was designed to operate. What they have created is not a legitimate government. They never got the legitimate authority to do these things. So anyway, going through all of these things, we covered the Madison's notes on the convention. We clarified how they define things. Then we also covered some points like James Madison's essay on property. We covered his memorial and remonstrance against the religious assessments. And then we covered the first petition of the Grand American Continental Congress, which is going kind of backwards. We went back up to the Tory Act. And then we covered the Treaty of Paris. We covered the Northwest Ordinance. We also covered that. We just did that recently. We also covered enabling acts. We covered Thomas Jefferson's proposed amendment. There were lots of things that we covered. As you go through this, it is not in order of how we covered it. Why? Because as we laid everything out, we were under the impression, so we leaned forward in the year, and we actually covered, and I don't see it up here, but I'm going to actually have to put it in because we covered it. We actually covered the Organic Act of 1871 because I was under the impression that the Organic Act was like, you know, the beginning of the end. But the Organic Act was the beginning of the transforming of our government into something that it wasn't supposed to be at all. the actual, I guess, the smoke or the blood on the hands of governors or those people who were elected to govern us, those acts actually began in 1816. When I wrote Why Counties Mattered Most last year, it was going through the Enabling Acts where I saw the federal government overstep their bounds in the Enabling Act, understanding what they had the authority to do in Article 1 or Article 4, Section 3. They didn't have the authority to basically tell that state how and what they were going to do when they formed. They basically told them to go create your constitution and create your state. Here's your boundaries of your state. You just need to be Republican in form. But instead, they started manipulating the framework and the responsibilities. It was just a little bit. And they used the Northwest Ordinance to justify this. So it was only within a month or two, the past 2 months, where we really started exposing these things. And the aha moment came from the Utah Enabling Act. That's when we started finding these references to old acts and articles that were created by Congress, all unconstitutionally, and this is how they got out of the framework, and actually how they've in parallel efforts, they tried to create a Department of Transportation, and in parallel efforts, after James Madison basically shut them down, they used enabling acts to empower them to do this without using the Constitution. They created a Ponzi scheme of basically stealing the sovereignty of the states, and the states unconstitutionally went along with it. Now, when you go along with somebody that's doing something without the authority, that doesn't make what they did legitimate. Even if you're a party to the compact, you allow things to be functioning and operating, you authorize things that violate the Constitution, you may be equally culpable, but it doesn't make it legitimate. The only way things can be legitimate is through an amendment to the Constitution by delegating the power. That is it. That's why we went through and are going through the ratification debates today. And that's what we've been covering as I go through we cover this with Tammy Young. So as I go through all of these other artifacts, we're proving to you how that Constitution was actually defined. That you look at our color-coded constitutions, this is how we've basically laid it out in how that the ratification debates have explained everything, which means that the Congress cannot create a law regarding something in Article 1, Section 1, Section 2, Section 3, Section 4. The only things that they can actually create law about and impose those laws upon the states is right there in Article 1, Section 8, or where they've been given the ability to do that. Very limited, like in Article 4, Section 3. They can create rules and regulations respecting the territory. But once it becomes a state, all bets are off. Or I should say, they do not have any power to create laws or anything placing upon a state. States are the sovereigns. They are the parties. They are the creators of that federal government. They are the parents of that federal government. And who are the parents of the states? The counties. That means that the counties have the responsibility of keeping that state in check. And, drum roll please, we're the people that create the counties. And we're the ones that are supposed to empower them. And here's the problem. We haven't done that. Even though the counties in form and framework, they are to represent us. And as it was laid out in the Constitution, it was even stated in the ratification debates. We've provided this to you, that it was clear that the states in relationship to the federal government equates to the counties in relationship to the state government. In other words, the states and the counties are the parties to those compacts. As they create the state They are the parents to it. Well, who's supposed to be creating the counties? This is the one government that, the one, have you seen those cartoons? The one job you had, the one thing you were supposed to do, the one thing that we the people have to do is we actually have to legitimize by creating that government. Which means today, folks, which means that we have and still have and will always have the ability to alter and change our government. What is our government? Our government is our county. And this is where we can start creating constitutions that can actually start changing the formation of that county government. This is why we can actually start pulling back all these powers. I'm going to explain this to you, because if you read this and why counties matter most, it does not summarize the simplicity of the process or the ultimate process of getting your state back in line. When one county creates a constitution pulling back all the powers, that does not make those powers legitimate. So that constitution will have to sit and wait, and it'll be in a on hold status. In other words, it will sit there in just this waiting status until enough counties have done the same duties in creating their constitutions. Ergo, when we have a majority of the counties of the state that actually have written their own constitutions demanding a reduction in the powers of the state, then you will have enough counties to demand a constitutional convention and actually form a county constitutional convention. This is where the county legislators will actually have the authority to, they don't even have to worry about the state legislature. They can actually go into a convention, and because most people think the courts have some control over this. They don't. We're a Republican form of government, not a judiciary. We're not an executive. We are not a monarchical. We are not a dictation. We are a Republican form of government, folks. And so when we actually have a majority, when I say a majority, not just 50% plus one, we want two-thirds. We want a good majority. And look at your state. If you're a blue state, do you have two-thirds of the counties that are red? I know Washington does. I know Washington can be moved into that two-thirds majority. It's going to take a little while, but I don't believe it'll take much time for Wyoming. I don't think it'll take hardly any time for Iowa, for South Dakota, for Missouri. I mean, Georgia. Look at Georgia. Georgia's got almost 200 counties. But if they all start getting it and they all start doing this, because most of those counties are red. Boom, 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 boom. So what is critical is that very first county constitution and how it needs to be framed in creating a self-governing system. In other words, folks, when you really look at the final article, I am going to lay out how the people need to serve in government on a regular basis. You need to go into it. And what that means is that you will become a part of a committee, whether that be infrastructure, whether that be, you know, healthcare, whether that be our social services, if you want to call it that. You call it's your county, you call it what you want. You identify what powers you want, but those powers belong to you, not the state, not the federal government. The more centralized, the less control you have. And we were given all control. So hopefully this starts making sense. So that when you actually start moving forward, you're actually taking back the power incrementally. Even though that power sits on a shelf in that constitution until you actually create. But when you do, when you have all of the counties that have basically kind of, I'll just say, parroted those same desires of pulling back those powers, then you can really create a limited and defined state government where it will not dictate to you anymore. That it only deals with the federal government on those very few things enumerated. And then as we start figuring out, well, we may want the states to have more responsibilities and take some things back. Like maybe patents. Like maybe bankruptcies. those types of things, because look at the federal government has created a perversion of patent laws and copyrights where they've become perpetual. The federal government has perverted the concept of bankruptcies, where your debt is, you know, expungible through bankruptcy, but their debt, no, you die with that, we'll come and take everything from you. How is that uniform? So we, after 250 years, we've learned a few of these little things that we need to tweak and pull back. One of the clarities that comes from the overall view from Madison, and I don't like citing the Federalist Papers because the Federalist Papers are very subversive. And we've done a show on this, folks, so go look for the Federalist Papers in the podcast. But when Madison basically gave a synopsis, one brief description, the federal government is external facing, that its focus is maintaining an advantage with foreign trade, making sure that we don't get taken care of. They're protecting us in foreign trade, and they're protecting us from foreign hostilities. In other words, their job is outward facing, to protect the Union from outside influences, whether that be military, whether that be economic, whatever. They're to protect the sovereignty of the Union and the individual states and the people. And so they're very limited to define. So the states, on the other hand, they're to basically take care of all domestic things. And so as we look at what to do and how to do this, all of a sudden things start becoming clearer of what we need to do at the county level. So with all of that, now I've covered this overview so that we can finally get to where we really need to be. And the one thing that I need to cover, I need to kind of wrap up, is the Home Department in the first year. So they were trying to create this Home Department. We were covering the Western lands and the fact that they were going to start selling lands before these lands became states, and to recognize how to help grow this manifest destiny. This is kind of the beginning of them seeing how they could actually make sure that the United States controls the land moving forward so that liberty would be preserved. A lot of things got perverted out the gate, or I should say, as things were laid out, there were those who wanted to start doing bad things. But let's just finish this. Mr. Gary, so this is actually, let me tell you where we are. We are in the first session of Congress. It is July 23rd. We're on page 694, and we're halfway down to where Mr. Gary comment there. You'll see Mr. Gary thought the burdens of the people would be sufficiently great in providing supplies absolutely necessary for the support of the government. Therefore, it would be improper to add expenses which might possibly be avoided. The people are viewing the proceedings of Congress with an attentive solicitude, and if they observe that we erect offices for which there is no apparent necessity, they will be apt to think we are providing sine curves or sinecures for men, which is a kind of an interesting word here. I need to look that up. But sinecures for men whom we favor. They will reluctantly pay what is extracted from their earnings to a government, which they think is regardless of economy. They will suspect a government further view in the change of government. They will suppose that we can contemplate the estimate of a monarchy by raising round the executive phalanx of such men as must be inclined to favor those of whom they hold their places. Mr. Vining, why do gentlemen say that such an office is unnecessary when they are forced to admit that all the duties are essential? Or how can they say it is more expensive to establish it in this way than another? Suppose these duties distributed in the manner which some gentlemen have mentioned, it is not fairly to be presumed that the departments to which any of them are attached will require an extra pay for these extra services. If so, will there be an economy in this mode of procedure? All that is to be wished for is to have a confidential person employed. Let his salary be what you please. If not, or if it is not worth $1,500 per annum, let it be $500. But it would be better to have a principal to manage the business than to have it consigned to clerks in the other departments. Mr. Lawrence said that something was necessary to be done with respect to the business brought forward by the honorable gentleman from Delaware. He conceived that an officer of the rolls of some inferior office ought to be appointed to transact the business detailed in the resolution. He did not insist upon making a great department. Mr. Sedgwick agreed with the gentleman. So this is going kind of round robin through the chamber of, you know, how they agreed or disagreed. Mr. Sedgwick agreed with the gentleman from New York, but he thought the business might be thrown into some other department and save the union the expense of the one which the gentleman of Delaware wished to establish by the name of the Home Department. He thought the resolution proposed altogether so improper that he hoped the committee would rise. A desultory conversation arose whether the committee should decide upon the resolution or not, after which a question was taken on the rising of the committee and decided in the negative. Then the question was put on the first part of Mr. Viney's proposition, quote, that an executive department ought to be established to be denominated the Home Department, close quote, and lost by considerable majority. So in other words, most of the people didn't want it. Now, we got about a minute and a half left, so I'm going to stop right here, and I will highlight, you know, where we've stopped at this juncture, because that's what I kind of do when we move forward. We're going to finish this. But the point is, when we read the constitutional debates, or I should say congressional debates, you will find that the people, the advocates, and the, you know, the proponents and the opponents, there is a lot of commentary. And usually the proponents kind of get up there and make a long sales pitch. And then what you hear are opponents that will come up and say this, say that, say this. That does not mean that there is an overwhelming disdain for, because when we look at the 14th Amendment, Professor Lash points out that you would think that the majority of Congress was against the 14th Amendment. But yet when it went to vote, it easily made the two-thirds majority. Easily in both houses, it made the two-thirds majority, which means that the 14th Amendment, regardless of all the rancor and the allegations that were proposed by the opponents, because this is where they start spinning, you know, their hyperbole. They do anything and everything they can, as everything has been logically put out by the proponents. The opponents actually, oh, the world of evil is going to descend upon us. And so you have to really look at how it went. And as we just saw here, they actually had a committee decide whether they were going to create a Department of Home, and it lost by a considerable majority. So with that, we'll come back and finish this on Friday. And then we'll start moving forward to where we can actually go the aha moment in the records. But I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract. and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.